more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
But there's actually photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
You're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Matt Vaughan.
And I'm Hannah Stewie. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students and postdoctoral fellows in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student or a postdoc at OSU, and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and podcast pages.
This episode of Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and tonight on the show, our guest is Charlene Perez-Santos, who is a first-year master's student in the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, working with Joshua Stewart from the Marine Mammal Institute. Charlene, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. Thank you guys for having me. I'm just excited to be here and talk a little bit about research, science, and life.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you here. Your research is really interesting, as is your story to how you got here. So I think maybe we'll start with if you can just provide an overview of your research and what you're looking at.
Yeah, of course. As Matt said, my name is Charlene. I am originally from Puerto Rico, La Isla del Encanto. I've always wanted to say that, guys. And my project focuses on the movement and habitat use of the DPS humpback whales. Two of those are the Central American endangered population, and the other one is a Mexican threatened. And what we're looking at, these two of these populations are on the Pacific coast, the west coast of Oregon, California, and cover up down to Mexico. We're seeing that during the winter season, they go to a bay called Bahía de Banderas to breed. And there has been some kind of strange behavior, like some courtship behavior that it's normally not seen on, and then feeding behavior that is not normally seen on breeding grounds. And then my research focuses on the side on how these two of these populations overlap with ship strikes, ship vessels, even if it's like large commercial vessels or like small vessels like water taxis, and how, what are the risks on both of those populations? That's like the major.
Cool. Just a quick clarifying question. When you say DPS humpback whales, what does that mean, the DPS part?
Yeah, those are distinct population segments. It's kind of like a way to say, I don't want to say subspecies of a species, but it's on that side of the science.
Okay. So they're all humpback whales.
Yeah, they are. They're just different, I want to say, like communities of whales around the coast. Yeah. And yeah, so one interesting thing about Bahía de Banderas, it's that the most important and only way of transportation to the locals over there are by pangas, or what we call small boats, like these mini vessels. And that's what we want to study further, like how these two distinct population segments are doing down there, because we don't really know the kind of overlap of these populations. And even in Yelapa, that's one of the like the smallest communities in Bahía de Banderas, fishing, it's like their most, they depend on fishing as their livelihood, economic impact. And that's why we want to really focus on, you know, creating conservation, but at the same time, assessing the impact that these humpbacks have So it's not so much about why are they moving, like why are they, what are the causes of the movement? It's more like, okay, this is the route they're going. This is the same route that this small boats are going. Let's see if they correlate, and if they do, what's the risk of the of their correlation?
Right, right. So you've got, essentially, you've got two populations, two different populations in different locations, and they're all going to this bay in Mexico, which we believe is for breeding purposes. How many whales do you get in that bay?
Oh, it's a lot. Like I talked to my PI about this, my advisor, and he said that he hasn't seen a bay with so much whales. And not only whales, there's like a lot of marine megafauna over there, like giant manta rays. And then killer whales also come down to the bay to feed on calves of humpback whales, beaked whales, minke whales, like a lot of marine mammals and cetaceans go down there. So it's a really interesting bay. This bay has, I don't remember the exact quantity, but it's part of the continental drift. And because of that, there's a lot of like zooplankton and marine food for marine mammals. And that's why a lot of these animals are visiting the bay. So there's like a lot of competition and everything. Yeah.
Is the fact like geographically that it is a bay and it's more protected from the open ocean also an impact on why it's a good breeding ground or a good place for all these marine megafauna to coalesce?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that we could say that. We have seen also that there's like a lot of at least the humpback whales are very close to the coast. So we can, maybe we can see it's more like they're curious about it, but also it's because this continental trench, it's so deep that they can feed anywhere along the bay. So yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's a big bay. So guide me through your research. As you told me the other day, you just got back from Mexico. So you just got back from your study site. How'd it go? What did it involve? Especially the details of like, how did you get there?
And
yeah.
Yeah. So I was, as you said, I was just back like 2 weeks ago from Mexico, where we deployed a total of 18 satellite tags on these humpback whales, individualized, 18 satellite tags. And then, so last year we also deployed 18, so we just wanted to leverage more data. And with this data, what I'm planning to do, it's kind of create a state-space model to overlap how the movement of these humpback whales is doing with the movements of the small vessels or pangas. So if I could summarize it in like three questions, like what are the three questions that I'm really trying to answer over here, is the first one is what is the extent and nature of overlap of these humpback whales with either fishing or also small vessels or large vessels. The other one is chip strike risk for humpback whales greater in this bay or in the U.S.? And that's why we're also leveraging some data from other research to see how it's comparing to this this vessels down in Mexico. And how are we getting this data, you know, from Mexico? We're collaborating with a project down there called Proyecto Manta. And what they're doing, their project is more towards the conservation of manta rays, like giant manta rays. So what they're doing is, Ileana, who's part of like the vice president of the project, she's deploying this GPS trackers on these small vessels and pangas on Mexico, I'll be using that data to kind of do the overlap between the humpback whales and also where the boats are going and what are they doing. And the other question we want to answer is the small vessel traffic and artisanal fishing effort near human population centers pose a risk to these humpback DPS. So that's like the overall questions. And about my trip to Mexico, that was my first marine mammal fieldwork. And it was amazing, honestly. It was like a dream come true. You know, escaping from the Oregon weather. That was, I think, the best nugget. But yeah, it was amazing. So we spent, I think, 10 or 12 days tagging this humpback whales. And the schedule kind of went like every day from 8 a.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m. looking for these humpbacks. And honestly, it was not that hard to find them because they were just everywhere. But also you could kind of see the impact because there were a lot of fishing boats. Like there were a lot of whale watching boats, a lot of these small water taxis, and you can kind of see like, wow, no, like even though there's a lot of whales, there's a lot of boats as well. So we just like looked for blows over the ocean, and then if we did find one, the first thing we did was take photo identification of the tail fluke. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you know, recording the coordinations, before all of, you know, the weather technical stuff, we were like, okay, let's go tag them. And sometimes I remember one competitive group, it was intense. We were like an hour after them. And of course, if we see that like that, the animal is kind of stressing, we leave it alone and just go to another humpback whale. But it was pretty intense just having 10, 12 humpback whales around you, like, and you following them in the boat. And then after tagging them, we also took some biopsies to kind of compare. This is another part of the study, but to kind of compare like what population there are, if it's a central or the Mexican DPS. And then after that, we just went back to Yalapa. And then the other day at 8 a.m. back on the boat and searching for more whales.
Wow.
Yeah. Something I'm curious about is, did you ever see any whales that looked like they were injured by ship strikes or entanglements?
Yeah, great question. So we did encounter this mother who was filled with parasites. It was very, very sad. It's called whale lice. You could see, we took some drone pictures and you could see the whale like full, kind of looked like white. It was full of parasites. And as well as that, it was tangled to a gillnet fishery. So that was like a perfect explanation of what's happening down in the bay. And then we even didn't decide to tag the whale because the probabilities of being dead like in a couple of months were like high. So and I remember that she was kind of like breaching very slow up the top and diving very slow. She didn't even try to escape or get away from the boat. It was like a very sad condition. Yeah.
Is whale lice something that is exacerbated by human intervention, or is that something that's very natural that you see happen? Yeah,
it can be. It's like kind of barnacles. It can be natural, but at the same time, it there's a lot of like ocean conditions that can also alter the quantity of whale lice. Yeah, it depends. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like really unique, your study area. You know, you've got, relative to the open ocean, you've got this small area where you're getting, you know, a ton of whales breeding. And you've also got just, you know, the human population in the area. You've got so many boats. I wonder, so I know your research is looking at answering this, but do you have an idea of how common the boat strikes are on the whales? I imagine any data that you do have is probably underreported. And also your work, I mean, you know, like you've only got so many boats tagged. So there's probably way more than we think.
Yeah, great question. I met a scientist over there, Nicola Ransom, and she has been doing some, she has a whale watching company and she's also a scientist. And she has been doing this research about kind of like the mortality strike that the whales have because of vessel strikes. And it's increasing by the year. It's believed that it's like the number one cause of deaths down in Bahía de Banderas, because it's a paper we're still in preparation, but it's like a lot of chip strikes happening over there. And even for the GPS trackers on the boat, there's so many boats that it's kind of like a hard step that we are kind of stuck right now, because one thing is, oh, you know, we can just leverage some GPS track on a boat, but another thing is we have to take into consideration the locals over there. So a lot of these Mexicans are really afraid of science just because they think that they're gonna get in jail because of they don't have these regulations, they're not following the rules. And even in Mexico, there's a lot of missing data for this, like the boats that are happening over there, the fishing, the mortality strikes that are happening over there. So it's kind of like a politics side of the science that we're doing.
Right.
So yeah, it's like very hard to also kind of create that relationship with the community first and tell them that it's not about getting them in jail or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's more like increasing the conservation efforts for the animal, for the humpback whale, but as well as for them. How can we also help them, like, increase their fishing? That's an example. Yeah.
Do you feel like as a Spanish speaker and as a Latina that you have maybe more like trust with individuals in this community, or that they might, you know, be more receptive to you?
I would say so, because even when I went to Mexico, even meeting the captain and some of the fishermen over there, I think I created like a really good connection and relationship with them just because I was Latina, and they feel kind of like more belonging. It's not the same if this random person from the U.S. comes without really acknowledging their culture or like their background or anything. And I think that since I'm from Puerto Rico and fishing, it's like a thing over there as well. So they kind of like related with my, like, I kind of related with them and try to put me on their shoes and see like what's going on over there. Yeah, I would say yes. But also, you know, if you can create a good relationship wherever you're from, that's good as well. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder as well, like, so with your data, this is I know you're a first year, mm-hmm. so you might not have got into this part of your project, but what, like, so you've got all these routes for the different boats and the mm-hmm. routes of the whales. Like, how can your data be applied? I wonder if, do you know if whales have like a specific route they take, like in the bay, and then maybe boats could avoid like a specific route?
Yeah, great question. They, like, talking with some of the fishermen and the captain of her boat, they knew, like, it looks like the whales are kind of dividing themselves in groups around the bay. Like, for example, the moms and calves are always found more on the south of the bay.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah, and then the competitive groups are on the north of the bay. So we can kind of see, it's not under science, but we're gonna see if the data tells us anything about that. But we can kind of see like a pattern around the bay that competitive groups stay more on the north side of the bay, and then moms and calves, because there are not a lot of boats on the south of the bay. The conditions are kind of iffy to get over there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the moms and calves stay. So we can kind of like correlate that with like, oh, are the whales moving this way because there are not a lot of boats, or why are they more here?
Yeah, yeah.
They're on the north side. But first we want to like assess the information, like, okay, this is where the boats are going, this is where the whales are going, let's see how they correlate, and then maybe like in future research we can answer that question, like, are they moving because of this, or what's happening over there? Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think this may be outside of the scope of your research with what, you know, you have available to you right now, but I wonder what the, like, how do you solve the issue, you know, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Matt was also starting to get out of, you know, what do you do once you have the information? Like, do you have to change the way that boats move throughout the water? Or do you have to, like, make a limit on how many boats can be in the water? And does that have huge economic impacts for fishermen and, I don't know, the tourism industry with whale watching boats or whatever that might be?
Yeah, I would say for, of course, that's like a, for, we want to like assess the information so we can get it out there to this like federal agencies and put more regulations on like what's happening with the boats. But at the same time, we don't want to put too much pressure, you know, on the fishing industry. But I would say that at least the goal is to kind of create a balance between both the conservation of the whale and also the preservation of the fishing industry down in Mexico. So I would say like for one of the, apart from like ship strikes, it's like the fishing sector, like humpback whales are being like entangled with gillnet fisheries. And that's like talking with people over there, they told me that there are, yeah, there are just regulations that you can put a gillnet fishery, a gillnet on the water if you're not there, but then fishermen come at night, throw the gill net, leave, and then pick it up back in the morning, and they're like this giant manta rays stuck and entangled, these caps on the net. So it's more of like creating not only these regulations, but not force the fishermen, but also create more like, what's the word? Make them pay for what they're doing, but kind of like, as well as creating the regulation, make sure that those fishermen are following those regulations and like having more people on the water and watching out to see if they're following these regulations. So yeah, that's a very hard question because, you know, fishing, it's like a big... So it sustains a lot of families down there. So we kind of, you know, as everything in science, we want to create a balance between, you know, the conservation of the species, but also the preservation of the livelihoods of these people down there.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, so much conservation happens when, you know, local or indigenous people have a sense of stewardship for the natural resources around them and the acknowledgement that you take good care of something around you to sustain it for the future and future generations.
Yeah. And that's a perfect point because even Proyecto Manta, before like asking them to, if they can put these GPS trackers on their boats, they first create a relationship with the community by providing workshops on how this project can help them and help as well the species that it's being talked about. So it's not only about, you know, putting these GPS trackers or putting out these new regulations, but also making a sense of stewardship around the species and why it's important to, you know, conserve the species. And even like talking with my captain during my trip in Mexico, he was like very personal with the whales. He was like, oh, he could even identify the whales from a distance because there's most of the day, like most of their lives, they're in the water. So they like perfectly know which are the whales that are breeding, which are the whales that are having babies, all of this. And it's like a good way to include conservation by also promoting a sense of stewardship. Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine like you really want to get to a win-win scenario where both parties benefit. And it's always really hard, like whenever you're in an area of the ocean that involves fishing, there's a lot of people invested, you know, in fishing. How was it going out on the boat and seeing a whale? Was this your first time seeing a humpback whale?
No. Not really. I went to some whale watching tours during my internship that over there in Maine, over Canadian waters. That was super fun. But up close, yeah, it was like my first personal experience. And honestly, I would say it's such a dream come true. Like, it's like very cliche, you know, everyone loves whales. Everyone's like into whales right now. But I always, this is kind of funny because I always cite like the Moana phrase, like, it calls me. It's like the whale just calls, they just call me. So it was just an amazing experience. I was super grateful. I even told my advisor, I was like, well, Josh, prepare yourself because you're going to see me cry when I see like a whale like coming close. And then after we like, because the first whale that I saw, it was a competitive group, like 10, 12 whales are fighting each other, escorting the mothers and everything. And it was pretty intense. And he was like, well, are you crying now? Like, are you, did you cry? I didn't see you like crying of emotion. But yeah, it was such an amazing experience. Just everything. And the people over there in Jalapa, this very small community, they were so welcoming and just such an amazing experience, really.
I'm trying to wrap my head around like that many massive whales, like, all moving around and like making a ruckus all in one spot.
Right. And you're probably on a pretty small boat as well.
Yeah, it was not a big boat at all. It was a comfortable boat, but it was not big. But I you have to be passionate about it, because even like talking with my to my friends about it, they were like, heck no, I'm not going to get in a boat with like 12 whales around you. And I'm like, why not? You know, so it's kind of like perspectives on what's your side of it. But I do remember the last day we were deploying some echo sounders and getting some more biopsies, because like we tagged 18 whales in 6 days. So it's like, if you compare it, there's a lot of whales down there. We had the trip scheduled for 2 weeks, and we didn't even come earlier to Oregon, back to Oregon, because we were just done tagging these whales. And I remember the last day, there was this mother who was sleeping, and then we came so close, like we were so close. And I remember that I had my GoPro, like my arm was all submerged in the water. I was like literally ready to go and swim with the whale. And then I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best footage I'm ever gonna get. This is like my moment with this whale. Like, she was super friendly. She came up, and I'm like, I was like crying. And then when I get the GoPro out, it wasn't recording. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Hold on to that memory tight.
Like, make sure, guys, that your GoPro, your camera, it's like ready to go when you have that.
Now you just got to replay it every time you're going to sleep, so it's solid in there.
I know. But yeah.
Well, you're super passionate about it. And like, I really want to get to your story of how you got here, because it's also really inspirational. I just have one more science question, if I may. So you said you're relating your findings to the US. Is that because like there's just more boats that attract, or are you also finding out like new information on the whale population movements based on your satellite tags?
Yeah, there's another student, Ali, who's analyzing the same data that I am analyzing, and she's studying the foraging behavior of these whales down in the bay, because they're also feeding in breeding grounds. And now there's like this new behavior that's happening with these whales, and that's why we want to like compare it with U.S. waters and see if maybe because of, you know, the whole general aspect of climate change, they're now moving down south to feed as well as breed. So, yeah, that's like why we're kind of also incorporating U.S. data to see, like, comparing it with previous years, like how the whales are doing. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'd love to talk a little bit about how you got here, where your passion for marine mammals and whales started.
Yeah. So I did my undergrad in the University of Puerto Rico in a very small campus called Humacao, which is on the east coast of the island. And this is the only public system college that teaches marine biology. And it's not because, it's amazing, even though it is, but it's because of its very limited resources happening. Even a couple of years back, there were some protests because they wanted to close the program, even though Puerto Rico is an island and we need marine biologists over there. And then I did my undergrad there with a bachelor in marine biology in a second concentration in wildlife management. And during those years over there, I wanted to expose myself to everything, like any opportunity I could have, even if it was not 100% related to marine mammals. I just wanted to have some experience because I knew that I wanted to go to grad school. And if I wanted to do that, I needed to have some kind of experience on anything, you know. So I just started doing this monitoring programs in bays, watching the impact of contamination in waters. And even I volunteered in the Conservation Center of Manatees for a couple of months. I even worked with anoles in the central side of the island, up in the mountains. I just wanted to expose myself to these experiences, but at the same time, I was 110% sure that I wanted to specialize in marine mammals. And this was a big deal for me because even though we have marine mammals that are visiting Puerto Rico, again, we go back to the same topic that there are very limited resources for science over there, and there are not a lot of marine mammals experts nor scientists. So I knew that I had to go outside of Puerto Rico to expose myself to the marine mammal field, and that's why I wanted to have some kind of experience in the island, even though it was not 100% related to marine mammals. And then on my fourth year, I started applying to internships, and I saw this NOAA internship. And even though the projects they were doing there were not related to marine mammals, I just wanted to be, you know, in an internship. I think that you can meet a lot of people over there. And then I got in as the first Puerto Rican. I was like, whoa, this is big. I'm so grateful for that. And then I was in a project about direct seafood marketing. And even though it was not working with marine mammals, we did have to study the impact that's happening right now with the North Atlantic right whale and the lobster fishing industry. So that's where I met a lot of marine mammals scientists that are working with right whales. And I was that was in the summer of 2022. I was like, this is my opportunity to just meet marine mammal scientists. I just started emailing people, contacting everyone I could, even it was not in NOAA, as well as NOAA scientists. And then long story short, when I came back, I was more sure that I wanted to do marine mammal. Mm-hmm. And it was my last year, and I was like, well, this is the moment to apply to grad school, but as well take advantages of everything you learn during that internship, apply to funding, because that's one of the biggest topics in grad school that we need, right? And then I just I remember that this whole process took my whole fifth year of college, just meeting people, asking them about the programs at their universities and everything. And there was this talk about applying to a fellowship with the NOAA called the LMRCSC. But the problem here was they weren't going to be able to fund me the first year of my master's. And long story short, Kaya Briggs, who's the director of the Alaskan Center for the marine mammal side over there in Alaska, she connected me with Lisa Balance, who's the director of the Marine Mammal Institute. And then she connected me with Joshua Stewart, who's right now my current mentor and advisor. And I just started talking with him about what I wanted to do. And he told me about this project, that it was just starting and that we can kind of approach this side of the ship strikes, fishing vessels, all that. And I was like, well, let's do it. And then he told me to apply. But again, there was no funding for the first year. And he's such an amazing, if you're hearing this, Josh, you're amazing. But he is an amazing advisor, that he was able to find me this fellowship that was able to fund me for my first year of my master's. And he was like, well, are you ready to come down here to go over here to Oregon? And I was so excited, but at the same time, I had no idea, like, what was I expecting? Because, mm-hmm. of course, exciting to do science, you know, study marine mammals. But at the same time, this Latina from Puerto Rico, I don't know, imposter syndrome, language barrier, Spanish is my first language. So it was kind of like this second thoughts just coming to my mind. And I even remember talking with one of my professors in Puerto Rico. I asked for him for a letter of recommendation, and he told me, well, you know, you should think about other fields in the marine biology, because a girl like you with very limited resources, not a lot of networking, won't be able to, like, be in one of the most competitive fields of marine biology. And at first, I didn't take it. Now that I tell this, I'm like, wow, that he should have not said that. But I didn't take it as a bad way. I just took it like, well, I'm gonna prove you wrong. And then when I got in, he was so proud. He was like, oh my gosh, there's this student from Puerto Rico who got into Oregon. I'm like, dude, you didn't even do anything. What are you doing? But that's just an example. If you really wanna, you know, if you're really sure on what field you want to specialize in, just go for it. Even if it's like the most competitive field ever, you won't really know until you try, you know, until you like try to apply to all of these universities. And if it doesn't work out, well, it was just not meant for you. And me as a Christian, I truly believe that something or someone out there was gonna help me to, you know, get where I wanted to be, like, for example, the marine mammal. And, you know, I saw walls turn into doors, into opportunities, and that's how I got here. That has helped me, you know, a lot during this transition to Oregon, leaving my little island, Puerto Rico. But yeah, it's been amazing. I guess I moved in September, so I haven't, like, been here a long time. Just waiting for the summer to come because of the weather. They keep telling me that the summer is so pretty, so I have high expectations, you see. Yeah. But yeah,
it's good for the summer. And honestly, I just want to say, like, I think you created those opportunities for yourself. It's so hard to try and create those opportunities when you're, you know, when you're in a completely different location. So your passion led you to getting here, and those NOAA fellowships that you got, I mean, they're not easy mm-hmm. to get. They're highly competitive. And yeah, I think it's amazing that, you know, you got yourself here. And I wonder with, like, have you always just had this passion for whales and the research you're doing now? This was ever since you were little?
Yeah. I have. I was raised in the north coast of the island. My dad's side of the family was a family of surfers. And I remember that I started surfing when I was 10, 11 years old. And I was just always very exposed to the beach. And just, I always wonder what's beyond the reef. Like, what's, I think that's a Nemo quote. And like a Nemo quote. I don't know. I'm not sure. That sounded like a Nemo quote. But
it.
Yeah. But I just always, like, Puerto Rico, it's known to the coral reefs. And that's like the science that's happening right now in Puerto Rico. But I just always wanted to see what was beyond the reef. Like, what's happening beyond, like, what are those marine megafauna that I can study out there? And yeah, I was super determined. Like ever since I was a little girl, I always wanted to go to the beach and whales. That was just like my thing. And yeah, that's how I think, honestly, I think I like was born with like this passion. I don't know. But it was, yeah, I just love whales.
I think it was meant to be for sure.
Yeah.
You have a lot of mental fortitude and resilience.
Definitely. And Thank you.
Inspired.
That's funny. Yeah. But I'm not going to lie, the transition, you know, leaving my family, I'm a very family person. I'm Latina, so I think that's like kind of stereotypical, but my mom lives in Florida, my dad lives in Puerto Rico. That transition, even though I thought it was not going to be that big, because I lived in Florida for 1 year and my mom lives in Florida, so you know, I've gone to the US, but traveling, like if you see on a map, just Google map Puerto Rico and then Oregon, it's like very far, and just everything changes. Like I haven't met many Puerto Ricans here in Oregon, for example. Like we have this really small group chat of the whole Corvallis area that it's made of 10 Puerto Ricans, and it's called Puerto Ricans in Corvallis. It's funny. And most of them graduated and went back to Puerto Rico. But it's a cool experience, because that has also made me think that I'm not here necessarily to diversify the program, but also because I am a good candidate and I'm a good scientist to be here. And I just keep telling myself that I don't have to prove to anyone that, you know, I can do it, because of course this is a learning experience. I think that all scientists know that you can be on top of the pyramid and you're still gonna, you know, you're still gonna be on the learning side of it. But yeah, I always keep telling myself as well that this is not for eternity. You know, my plan is to, everything that I learned here in Oregon, I want to come back to my island to help what's going over there. Like I know it sounds like very big, but I want to be one of those marine mammal scientists in Puerto Rico, because even now there has been news of these humpback whales and killer whales in Puerto Rico on the west side of the island, and there's not much research about it. And so the research there is, it's from a scientist there in the U.S. that just visit Puerto Rico and go. And I want to be like a Puerto Rican that study, you know, whales in Puerto Rico. That's like the ultimate goal.
That's the end goal.
Yeah, that's the end goal right now. Before it was going to grad school, and now it's that.
Yeah, you got to keep pushing the goalpost.
Sometimes I'm like, you should take a break, Charlie. And I'm like, I don't know. I just want to go further. But yeah.
I think if anyone can do it, you can do it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, stop.
No.
No, you
I'm
got this.
I'm
going
to second that. Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see. I would say if it's meant to be, but also you just can't stand by and wait. You just have to, you know, work. If you want to do it, I mean, that's how I got into here, because even people told me that it was going to be very hard if I just stood back and just waited and see, well, we'll see how it goes. Well, I probably would not be here. So it's also like, if you want to do it, do it. Don't wait like to do it. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 What's that saying? Like the second best time was yesterday and the best time is now.
Oh, I haven't.
I've never heard that.
No, me neither. Cool. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So sounds like you embrace the now.
I do.
Yeah. Should we move on to the traditions? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a natural segue. So on ID, we have a couple of traditions. We'll start with the first one, that is asking you for a piece of advice to any audience of your choice, whether that be undergraduates, grad students, people in Puerto Rico, your younger self.
Yeah, I would say this is like for any underrepresented or any undergraduate or any student out there listening, that if they're really passionate about something, first off, don't wait and expect to just appear out of nothing. You have to work hard for it, but also take advantage of all the opportunities that you have. Even if they're like the smallest opportunities, just take advantage and apply to everything. Like, apply to every internship you can, because the internship progress is like very hard, but because of the internship, I was able to get to know all of the scientists, and that led me to where I am right now. So I would say, like, even if you think that you're not qualified to, you know, apply or to get into this big internship, just try. And if you do, create long-lasting relationships and connections with people over there that may help you to get where you want to be. So just take advantage of those opportunities and not just stand around. Even it sounds kind of like extreme, but just not stand around, like be determined and like achieve your goal on the long run, even if it's like the most competitive field. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Like, a lot of people undersell themselves, and the people applying for the internship, so many people feel that same way.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people listening, that will resonate with them. So awesome advice. This is probably going to be really hard for you to name a favorite thing about your research.
Oh my gosh, it is. I have so many, but I would say that the first, like the most important thing will be that this project has a large scale impact, not only for the conservation of the species, but also by providing real-time information to what's happening there in relation to the fishing industry and the vessel industry. It can create kind of like an understanding but of both the species, but also the fishing and everything that's going down there. So it's, I would say that, you know, Mexico being a Latin place, a Hispanic place, I also kind of like want to make the best for them, because I relate to what they're going on over there. So it's kind of like I'm on both sides of like doing science with this humpback whales, but at the same time, I'm able to provide real-time data and information to what we can do to both help the species and like the people living, the locals living over there. Yeah. I would say that.
Amazing. And then lastly, you got to choose your outro song for the episode. So if you could tell us what song you chose and why.
Okay. One reason and two words. Very easy. I'm Latina. That's it. That's all I'm going to say. Hope you guys enjoy the song. I know it's kind of late to like hear this song. You're going to see why. Just have a little salsa. Just have a little flavor in your life. If you want to dance, if you're driving, please stop. Like, drive safely. Yeah. Just enjoy the song. And why not? You know, it's never too late to like have fun.
You've got me pumped for the song.
Oh, wait till you see.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's really awesome to hear about your research and especially your story to how you got here.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
It was great. And I'm so excited for you and your future.
Thank you, guys. And no, I'm really grateful for the opportunity. And this is a good platform, not only for, like, underrepresented students, but also to all students out there hearing and people just in general, early career scientists and everyone. So thank you. Very grateful.
I'm looking forward to the marine mammal research that you're going to be doing in Puerto Rico and the
cool
program you're going to start up.
Let's see if you're hearing, you're a NOAA, like a NOAA, not NOAA, but a scientist in Puerto Rico, please reach out.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks.
Thank you, guys. Puerto Rico me lo regaló. Dominicana ya repito.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, tell your friends about it and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at KBVRID.
This theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hamad. Special thanks to the supporting staff at KBVR that allow the show and podcast to be possible.
This show was started by Jean Kamvar and Joey Hulbert in 2012. To learn about our current hosts, other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, visit our website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration. Thanks again for listening, and stay curious, my friends.